Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson Hill. Welcome to the show. And sitting across from me none other than...
Back again, just like, you know, like a bad penny or something. I mean, people don't say that. You got Mike Costantino over here. We,
Beloved co-host.
On Labor Day,
we want First and only beloved co-host so far.
First and only beloved. I mean, Gary hasn't... We got Gary LeMaster over here. Hasn't quite replaced me yet, but working on it.
I couldn't replace you.
That's exactly
irreplaceable.
I missed a few Mondays, and it feels good to be back on especially Labor Day. If you're working today, you have our sympathies. If you're not working today, go hug a union member or at least a union sympathizer, because this is how we get most of the workers' rights in this country. It's certainly. What is it now? Power never gives up anything without a demand. Is that Frederick Douglass? I forget who said that. But here we are on Labor Day talking about...
What's the history of Labor Day, Gary?
I was just going to say, when you mentioned unions, Labor Day was born out of the Pullman strike, Pullman rail car strike.
What's a Pullman?
A Pullman is a sleeper car, for railroads. And... the workers, some were laid off, and so the rest of them went on strike in 1894. And as a result of that strike, a couple of months later, Congress passed a law declaring this day Labor Day.
Yeah. When I was growing up in Oklahoma, our whole little town celebrated Labor Day out at the lake. The kids, we would go fishing and also eat lots of food, and the adults would sit around and talk. And so it was celebrated by the whole town. It was a major holiday back in the old days.
Keep in mind, a lot of people didn't have weekends off at that point.
That's true.
Mike wanted to mention the elections here, and I don't have much to say about them except that, you know, we've been talking about, when we first started talking, Mike, about dark money 3 years ago, I don't think people even heard the term. And now, you know, every time you open the Arizona Republic, there's a reference to dark money.
Right.
And all the guys who, the conservative members of the Supreme Court and the conservative, advocacy groups that got Citizens United in are now, it's kind of paying the price. It's come back to bite them on the derriere.
I hope so. As it should. I mean, they completely changed. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, speaking of Supreme Court justices, and who hasn't believes in the whole system and doesn't make a lot of public statements, made public statements about it's changing the system. The money, the Supreme Court's decision to allow money to flow to campaigns without identity is the key here, is changing the system. And that's, she doesn't see as being a good thing for the Constitution.
Well, it's millions of dollars. I mean, millions of dollars were spent in the Corporation Commission race by anonymous sources. Corporation Commission controls the utilities. People think that APS is secretly funding a lot of it. But the Republican candidates use dark money, incredible amounts of dark money and groups and everything else in this campaign.
Localizing it once again. When you see the reporters talking about, you know, spending so much money. I mean, they're just aghast at the money spent on the Arizona Senate race or the Arizona House race or even the statewide offices. You know, when people are spending millions of dollars for statewide offices in Arizona, where just a year or two ago, if they spent $200,000, it would be news. Now they're spending, you know, how much did Ducey spend?
I don't know, but it's the,
$5 million.
It's the largest amount of money ever spent on a governor's race was thrown in. And Christine Jones put in a couple of $1 million of her own money.
Her
boss put in $1 million. It's a lot of self-funded people, but you have to wonder where the money's coming from. I mean, who cares about the Corporation Commission unless you're somebody who's getting regulated by it? And we had this vicious fight between some Republicans who were sort of in favor of solar energy in a very mild way against the anti-solar people, and the money poured in for the anti-solar people, and they won.
Well, from the utility that they're going to be regulating. I mean, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
And APS isn't hiding it. It's not, well, so that's the news of the next few
weeks.
They
won't answer the question of whether they were behind the dark money.
But they won't deny it.
No.
So they're not hiding
it. They never denied it, Mike.
So that's a big deal, I think. That's a very big deal when you have the Fox watching the hen house, so to speak, that these people are funding the people that are going to be regulating them. That's called corruption in any other country, in any other state.
Should be illegal.
But we do want to mention that the two statewide GOP offices that the incumbents lost, that's a big deal.
Yes.
Huppenthal and Horn, that the two GOP incumbents are out of their race. They lost in the primary.
These are the egg on face guys.
No matter how, you know, the power of the incumbent is something that usually can't be denied. But these guys are out of their own race because, quite frankly, they did such crappy jobs.
Yeah.
And they were such crappy guys.
And federal investigations and indictments has a little something to do with it, too.
Might have a little bit to do with it. We wanted to talk today, folks, about the militarization of police forces.
Yeah, that's our topic.
That's our topic for today. It was a really interesting election. I don't think it's going to impact this issue, particularly one way or the other.
Before we go, do we give any shout out to Sandy Moriarty, who's been on the show several times, and Angela Lefevre? We haven't done that, so let's do that. We just did that.
Okay.
Hey, Angela. Sandy. Sandy is the new mayor of Sedona.
Yes, we have new folks elected in Sedona. We have one runoff race for city council, hasn't been decided yet.
Oh,
I feel bad for those guys because they got two more months of campaigning to go. But let's talk about the militarization of the police, because it is suddenly a hot item in the news, and it is so because of Ferguson, Missouri. Ferguson, Missouri is one of these suburbs of St. Louis. St. Louis, the actual city of St. Louis, is fairly small. It's surrounded by suburbs. In the late 60s, when I was in East St. Louis, which is across the river, it's one of the most segregated places I've ever seen out of the Deep South. I mean, there was just a line down the middle of this road, and black folks were on the south side and on the white folks on the north side. So it's an area where there's been a lot of tension. And what's the date on that? August 7th, something like that. August 9th. Michael Brown is walking down the middle of the street in Ferguson, and he gets into an altercation or something happens. He's unarmed. He's 18 years old, and a police officer named Darren Wilson shoots him 8 times and kills him. And this caused extreme disturbance in Ferguson. And we don't know a whole lot about the case. In a lot of ways, there's all these different, if you read the different eyewitnesses accounts, there are many self-serving eyewitness accounts.
Yes.
And there's been the complete polarization about this. So, some of Michael Brown's friends present him as this really sweet, kindly guy who never did anything wrong in his life. And then, the police department leaked videos and stills of him strong-arming a owner.
They didn't leak them. They actually presented them.
You're right.
Way.
They presented them in the police chief presented them in a police conference
When they were asked not to by the Department of Justice.
Yeah, and so they want to say, this is a really, really bad guy. Look what he just did. He's walking down the street. He's not an innocent. He's 6'4". He weighs almost 300 pounds. He's a threatening guy. He's not jaywalking. He's walking down the middle of the street in a provocative way. But in the United States, there are just hundreds of incidents going back, or thousands going back decades, of black men being treated differently than white men in terms of the police response.
I think it's fascinating that we don't have a nationwide statistic on police homicides. In other words, how many people the police have killed. There is no nationwide statistic, and that's on purpose. That's so you can't tell how many of our own citizens cops are killing.
So you have a town of Ferguson which has, I think, 3 black police officers, about 50 police, mm-hmm. and you have an almost entirely black population. And for the local residents, the police force feels more like an occupying force than it does like somebody who represents them. And this is traditional in the black community now. And I come from Oklahoma, and the difference between the way police treated black folks and the way they treated white folks was completely radically different. The experience of the police as somebody who keeps you in line, keeps you down, is throughout the South and also the North, because when folks immigrated to the North from the South to get away from all the Jim Crow, they encountered a discrimination up there. So the police respond with a lot of heavy equipment. There's a photograph of a sniper sitting on a Bearcat armored car pointing at people. They respond in extremely, what seems to most of the press and stuff, extremely provocative way. They throw tear gas at some of the reporters. They shoot them with rubber bullets
if they're reporting what's happening.
Yeah. So that's how it starts. That's how it becomes a big topic of discussion. But the militarization of police, right, Gary Mike, had been going on for decades.
Yeah, well, let's finish up Ferguson, at least the young man, Michael Brown, got the death penalty for being a jerk. I mean, for being a big, tall, heavy jerk, as a matter of fact. He was not respectful. He was not a nice man. But we don't usually administer the death penalty. If we did, there's a whole lot of guys that would be in front of Michael Brown and would be dead.
Right. Nothing he did in terms of, first, it's kind of interesting that he has no criminal record, no cases where he's been convicted of anything. And the police officer shot him, Darren Wilson.
He was not armed. He didn't even have a wallet in his hand. He had nothing in it. There was no question whether he had an
That he was unarmed. There wasn't an ambiguity. Darren Wilson had been on the police force for 6 years. He'd never had a complaint.
But he came from a police force in the next door suburb that was so racist. That's where he was trained. And the police force was so racist that it was disbanded.
Yeah. But we don't know about him. All we know is that these are two guys who, frankly, given the situation, have been in less trouble. I mean, we have police officers there's one fellow in Maricopa who shot 2 or 3 or 4 people, and there's a lot of questions about his tactics. And neither one of these gentlemen was there a long trail of evil doing. And yet it ends in bloodshed. Michael Brown shot 8 times,
yeah,
twice in the head.
Yeah. That's anger. That's rage. I'm sorry. They'll be talking about this for the, you know, forever, but at least on this side of the microphone, I know what I think anyway.
So even if you're not the world's nicest guy, and even if you have some attitude, you shouldn't be shot dead. You're 18 years old.
Yeah.
Who knows, his whole life was before him. Darren Wilson's life has got some problems now too. That's how this starts. This is how it gets to be the great, large, encompassing news story, and everybody goes and investigates the militarization of police.
Let's talk about the other side of it just for a second, because my students talked about the cop, Darren Wilson, that he's sitting in his house and can't leave it and shouldn't leave it and probably can never leave it without the threat of being killed. I mean, there are people, lots of people, you know, so the way the world works, my teenagers understand, is that his life's over, at least as far as walking around free.
Yeah, I don't know whether I agree on that, but the storekeeper who Michael Brown strong-armed robbed, made a point of declaring that he didn't call the police. So there's that much fear running around rampant.
There's some debate over whether or not Brown actually paid for the items, too.
Yeah,
I saw some articles along that. So there's lots of questions, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a phony thing. I saw the things about him not having paid. you can't explain his attitude and the body language and stuff toward the storekeeper. This is a small man. He comes out and runs and tries to stop. If he had paid, this would have happened. So I know that they're saying he paid, but I don't believe it. So, but in any case, Michael Brown's dead. That's the terrible thing. And his crimes were, well, first he didn't have much of crime. Walking down the middle of the street, kind of arrogant, but it's not necessarily something, a death penalty case. So how does militarization of the police start? Gary, Mike?
Our generation, the 1960s.
They got mad at us.
It's the anti-war movement of the 1960s.
It starts in L.A. The first SWAT team is created in L.A. It's created by some famous...
Where else?
Yeah. Daryl Gates created the... he goes on to be L.A.'s chief of police, creates the idea of a SWAT team. And his predecessor, Parker, was sort of against it because he thought it crossed the line of combining military stuff with policing, which he thought was a bad idea. And Parker was a notoriously tough guy who was, how to phrase it, not always on the right side of the law himself with his policing policies.
Right.
So it starts then, civil unrest. We need to arm ourselves. We need to be able to deal with this. And they go to the military and they look at, I think originally Marine Corps, so sort of SWAT teams and snipers and stuff, as the way to get the training that they need to deal with these situations. And then it goes along for decade after decade.
1997, they started the 1033 program, which is a Pentagon program, which really started the military hardware flowing to local police forces. And Alan Grayson introduced a bill just recently to stop that. And certainly it did not pass 62 to 355. And some of the Democrats said, at least that... The perception is that local law enforcement doesn't get a lot of support or doesn't get enough support. And if the federal government wants to supply these guys with some hardware, some stuff that is better and bigger than the crooks have, well, then who's going to get in the way of that? At least that's the perception. Some of us think that the militarization of our local police forces is a threat to democracy.
And creates a problem. So let me give you some examples. Yavapai County, they got 93 assault rifles, 87 night vision goggles. They have 6 armored cars. Coconino, 68 assault rifles, pistols, shotguns. Maricopa. 1,696 night vision goggles, 406 assault rifles, 128 pistols, 9 shotguns, 7 armored vehicles, 4 mine-resistant vehicles, and 2 planes.
And if you look at the Verde Valley, SWAT team based in Cottonwood has 3 Humvees. They use 2 for the SWAT team; the other is used somewhere else. A Bearcat armored vehicle, and they also got camo uniforms. I don't understand why you need camo. And military assault rifles.
I looked at one other place. First, I looked at Oklahoma City, which, of course, if I look at Oklahoma, it's not like good news. Yeah. But I looked at Burley County, North Dakota. The population in Burley County is 81,000. They got 353 assault rifles and an airplane, plus a bunch of other miscellaneous stuff. This is a little town of 81,000.
Well, there's
353 assault rifles?
Well, the other thing I think that we know is, at least I remember from the military and from and when I was in the local guard, it was me and a bunch of cops in the Arizona Army National Guard. But once one chief down the road gets something, with police and fires especially, if somebody's got something, then the next chief in the next town once is going to try and get it too.
On one of the programs, you have to use the equipment within 1 year in order to keep it.
Oh.
Which is, it's going to make, I got to use that armored car somewhere or they're going to take it back type of feeling.
You know, I think I have to put in my two cents worth in that why I think this is going on is that never underestimate the impact of fear. You know, a lot of this is being sold in, you know, about terrorists coming across our border. And,
yeah,
and
exactly.
So we have to be prepared for the worst case scenario. And the other thing I think is I can't emphasize enough is our, in, you know, being enamored with military toys. We have a football game and we have a flyover of jets. Almost every opening college football game and pro football game has a flyover of military fighter jets. Every parade is got some military representation. And people, kids grew up being enamored with machine guns and tanks.
Very
and
true.
You know, it's such an endemic part of our culture that it's celebrated in almost every public event.
Well, in many coffee shops and many bars, I ask this question with enough caffeine or alcohol. Are Americans a warrior race? Are we a warrior race?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, and people like you that think about it, but most people kind of are taken aback and don't know how to answer. If they think about it, they will come up with your...
According to my research, all but 33 years of our existence, we've been at war.
But we don't think of ourselves as a warrior race.
You know, that's actual combat, not just little minor police...
We think we're more Greece than Sparta, but that's... I don't think... The other thing I want to... You know, we mentioned already, it took root in the 60s, but... It was continued heavily with Nixon and Reagan with the war on drugs. The war on drugs, people felt, certainly they had a lot of support nationwide for increased hardware. So
that's right, Mike. I think that's how the SWAT teams originally get spread. And the ACLU did a really good report. I'll have the name for it. It's called War Comes Home: The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. And they found that 62% of the SWAT team actions were against drug dealers.
Right.
So that's been the main 28% on the rest of it.
And so it was okay to arm them as much as we could. And then, like I say, we have this 1997 program, and then we get 9/11.
And there's supervision. There's nobody looking over the shoulder from the Justice Department or anywhere else how the equipment is used.
Actually, some of the recipients have sold the equipment for profit for their departments, and there's I saw a story where they were trying to track all the missing weapons that there are Humvees missing from departments, and there are a lot of assault weapons that have disappeared, and the departments can't account for them.
Well, I'm not sure. Yeah, that's interesting. They're probably in some libertarian's garage somewhere waiting for the final Armageddon. That's
when I was growing up, one of my friends had a bazooka that he had stolen from the National Guard.
There you
and
go.
He went and shot a cow with it just to see what would happen. So, you know, the problems that go way back, but that's one person, one guy with one bazooka.
He's not alone. I had training in martial arts. I had a friend that I was training with that I went to his home, and he had a large bedroom stacked to the ceiling with machine guns and shoulder-fired rockets and grenade launchers and stuff that he had been training the military, and so he had been given this stuff in exchange for his training.
Well, to be fair, first of all, I'm going to jump on both sides of this one too. You know, 5 months down at the police academy does not train you to use the kinds of equipment that are flowing to police forces. However, most of these guys receive, most of this, the SWAT teams and the other heavy armored teams get some training from the federal government, or at least from federal agencies, to use the material that they're getting. Not all of them, I'm afraid, and we can probably name lots of exceptions.
Well, if you look at the Ferguson Police Force, suppose we're not taking sides on the issue in one way or another, Ferguson Police Force is pretty incompetent. They do everything wrong. They provoke a situation that could have been handled much better. They don't know what they're doing. They arrive with all this heavy equipment, and bringing in all this military equipment is a representation of the psychological state. They're viewing the population as being other than themselves. The minute they get somebody to come in who can identify with the people there, it begins to break up this them or us problem. And,
right.
and there's always a them or us problem with police and the public. That's just been constant and it probably always will be. But in Ferguson, it's just their response is so over the top and so miscalculated that it feels like they were never trained or they didn't know what they were doing because they managed to escalate a minor thing into a major thing for no particular reason.
Well, you're right. It is training and procedures. It does not seem like the Ferguson Police Department has benefited from some of the more modern training and how to handle some situations.
Well, I'd like to talk about the modern training. It's If you delve into this, first of all, the 1033 program is a great boon to the government in order to get rid of a lot of equipment that they no longer use.
It's kind of a jobs program that Republicans can support.
My nephew was in Iraq as part of the surge, and found that they were planning on burying most of the equipment. The unarmored Humvees were going to be buried in the desert, and because it was allegedly more costly to bring the equipment home. So it's a great boon to military contractors and to the military to be able to get rid of it so they can make more.
Exactly.
The other thing is I've trained in martial arts now for going on 40 years. And I know you do and I've trained a lot of bouncers and some police and FBI, agents, and, you do what you're trained,
you know,
and so what's going on with the training with police forces these days is, companies like Glock, in order to sell their guns into the police department, offer these, free training seminars. Well, they bring in the people doing the training are Blackwater and other private military contractors, and they're training them in military, techniques. So when next door to Ferguson, there was a shooting, about a week later of a young black man who was allegedly armed with a knife. I watched the video and the guy was dead within 15 seconds of the police showing up, the first squad car with two cops in it. And they got out of, the guy was showing no violent tendencies. They got out of the squad with their guns drawn. So if your first response or your first reaction is to draw your gun instead of your taser, instead of your baton, and you feel at all threatened, the first thing you're going to do is use what's in your hand, which is your gun. And that's what they did. They fired something like nine shots into him in a couple of seconds. And he was still probably 8 to 10 feet away from him. I've personally been attacked with a knife and disarmed it unscathed. It's not that difficult. And I didn't have a Kevlar vest. Or a taser or a baton, it's to me, it's a matter of how you train the police forces.
One of the things the ACLU report did was to look at, these teams that go in and, everybody has them in Britain, in France, they're armed response teams. We call them SWAT teams here. And look at the amount of violence they do in arrest. In other words, most of their arrests are of drug offenders, and it'll be a whole lot of guys, 10, 15 guys going and smashing down doors. Children have been killed in these incidents.
They've broken into the wrong homes.
They've broken in the wrong homes, gotten into a shootout with some guy who just got out of the military and blasts away. The reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who wrote a really interesting article summing all this stuff up, his own research suggests that these SWAT team raids have resulted in 50 innocent people being killed. The stun grenades, the shooting, it's neighbors, it's people in the way, it's somebody who happens to be there, it's a kid in the next room in a crib. 50 people, and he's looking at a fairly short period of time, and it's not a big report like the ACLU studying hundreds of cases over decades. It's one reporter's investigation.
Yeah, that's outrageous that the state would kill innocent people.
What happens, they have all the equipment, they have the teams, and they're using them when they're not necessary in a drug raid. You know, there are times when you really need SWAT teams. I mean, the entire world uses equivalent of
SWAT
teams.
And the control of the situation
for violent
criminals.
Yes, it's safer for everybody to have a SWAT team. But they're usually accompanied by detectives and stuff who look sort of like human beings because the SWAT team members, modern SWAT team members, look entirely armored. They're faceless. But 50 people killed by SWAT teams. And so there are, I don't know if I have the statistics, but there are 50,000 raids, 50,000 SWAT raids in the last few years, 50,000 raids across the country. I saw another figure was a little bit different, but that's a lot of raids. That's a lot of smashing in doors and stun grenades and shooting anybody who moved. That's a lot of raids. And it's because there's so many raids that you get so many innocent people being killed, I think.
I think one of the things that came up was in police recruitment videos that you can find on YouTube and whatnot. And that's what often is in the videos are the big guns and the, using these kinds of weapons, to recruit people. But as most of us know, most of police work is pretty boring stuff. I mean, it's dealing with people, it's dealing with paperwork, it's dealing with mostly the mentally challenged, as you've heard me say before on this show, the largest mental health facility in Yavapai County is the Yavapai County Jail. The largest mental health facility in the nation is the L.A. County Jail.
Of the three or four police I knew in New York, none of them had ever fired a weapon in pursuit of duty. I mean, they'd arrested a lot of guys. Most of them were detectives. They'd never fired a weapon. It has never been necessary. In the old days in New York, they had a 38 revolvers. They started getting... They said, anyway, getting outshot by...
Not enough stopping power. They want to stop them with one shot.
Yeah, with the gangsters got pretty bad. And then there was the famous, we were talking about the show, before the show, about the shootout in L.A., where these heavily armed, heavily armored vest guys shot it out with the police. After a bank robbery.
And we're just standing in the middle of the street. Knowing that they couldn't be hurt between the body armor and the firepower they had... I mean, you got the cops hiding behind their cars and their doors and all of them. So this is when it really exploded. They felt like they looked bad.
They were also, in addition to using body armor themselves, they were using armor-piercing bullets.
Yeah,
automatic weapons.
And their automatic weapons. So the police were outgunned. They were definitely outgunned.
And so there is. We're not saying there's no reason for arming the police well, and that there's no reason not to have vests and stuff. But when you come to armored cars, now what is Joe has a Joe Arpaio down there has a tank, all this stuff. It's a question of the attitude toward the public. Now, public is not always sweet, nice, kindly guys. They don't like being stopped for a parking ticket. They certainly don't. If I'm standing there, somebody points a rifle at me, they've lost, a friend right there. I'm not happy. And the public doesn't like being beat up on or being stopped for no reason. And so what I see the militarization, and you guys can maybe disagree or agree with me, is that what I see the militarization doing, all this equipment, is aggravating a problem that pre-exists about the difference between the, there's always going to be a difference between the people enforcing the law and the citizen. There's always going to be it. And even, you know, when I was growing up, it wasn't totally ideal. The, you know, like in my hometown in Oklahoma, we had firearm safety training from the town marshal every summer. We knew him. Everybody knew the guy in the town. A friend of mine came to visit him. One of the police led them to my, my house. But, you know, you had the other side, which is that, you know, is that a lot of Wild West stuff. There was a bank robbery in Tulsa, and they ended up in a field near Claremore, where I grew up. And the fellow who robbed the bank had a hostage, and they were out negotiating the hostage release, and they were getting there. It was almost going to happen, and I won't use his name, but the sheriff pulled up in his pickup truck, took out his deer rifle, shot the guy in the head. The negotiators were really pissed off, but, you know, it's all over. The guy is dead. So there's, you know, we're not idealizing the past, but I think that there really is a growing disconnection between police and the public.
There's been studies recently that, you know, I saw a documentary on a report on, I think it was the Providence, Rhode Island police force that had an area that was, you know, fairly high crime. And instead of, you know, they took the cops out of the squad cars and they had them going back to foot patrol, walking the streets, and lo and behold, the crime dramatically dropped because the cops were there getting to know the people in the community. They weren't considered, you know, threats or outsiders that were keeping the people down. They were communicating with them, and they could spot, you know, trouble more quickly that way. So it had a profound effect on the crime rate, and they've seen that over and over again when it's been done. Yet we still continue to put cops in, like in Minneapolis, where I lived for a lot of years, they have cops in SUVs that look like Darth Vader vehicles. You know, the vehicles themselves look threatening.
Yeah, seeing an officer outside of a car is an unusual vision. You know, you always see them in some sort of vehicle.
It doesn't take much, I think, sometimes to break things down. When I was in New York, I was on several juries. And on one jury, the minority folks were tremendously skeptical of the police. While white guys, we went in, we basically believed whatever the police said as a starting point. I mean, if they said something fishy, we would get the minority folks in the 80s just didn't believe a word of it. And they had to have some sort of objective confirmation that what the guys were saying was true. And I remember one woman on a jury who was, we start out 11, you know, end up 11 to 1. We have a holdout and we start out, you know, 6 is divided juries. And one woman was a woman, and someone had a Hispanic woman, Puerto Rican woman, and someone had tried to rape her, and she had gone into the police station. Instead of being treated unsympathetically, they were sympathetic. They took all the information. And what impressed her, she told me afterwards, that the police gave her a ride home. And the police officer gave her his card and told her to call. One little gesture like that can break down a lot of suspicion.
Right. And that's why I think the cops on the beat, foot patrols, has a big impact because they're people suddenly. They're not the armed enemy, you know.
Along those lines, sort of get the risk too, but the school resource officers, get them when they're young, at least to have some positive feelings toward toward the law enforcement. I think every school in every city should have, elementary, high school, I don't care what it is, should have at least one school resource officer or whatever they want to call them, and he or she should be required to wear their uniform. A lot of school resource officers are not required to wear uniforms.
I'm not sure I agree. I think the idea of, maybe it's just I'm old fashioned, the idea of having a policeman in a school is like, is that really necessary?
Well, we see it. Because I was in those situations, it was helpful to have him or her grease the wheels of their bureaucracy. If you needed something or a student needed something, from law enforcement, a court issue, all sorts of things that you might have to deal with law enforcement, that resource officer could grease those wheels. You're looking at it the other way around, which certainly is, but that's not what I thought of when I thought of saying that. The other way around is that they're there to arrest them or to be their Johnny on the spot when somebody steps out of line. I didn't think of it that way. I thought more that there's a chance to see this positive, this guy doing these positive things in this institution and being being more willing to support law enforcement. I think we all want to support law enforcement. We're all, bleeding heart liberals and talking trash about cops right until we need one. And then, by God, he better be there in a minute and a half.
I guess I don't have a position on it, Mike. It's good to hear what you have to say. I just kind of creeps me out having police in a grade school. I mean,
don't
come
you
on.
Think it has a lot to do with the personality of the school officer? I think if that officer is well trained and is outgoing and becomes a teacher.
Exactly.
And that's I think that can have a profound effect on the kids as they get older. But if that cop is a bully and prances around and is a tough guy, then I think it has a different impact.
Surely. And I have to admit, that's my experience has been what you said about these guys that were well trained. They had whatever community relations classes they had took, and they were these guys, mild guys of who knew procedures, who knew the procedures that they needed to handle all manner of situations, and weren't the other kind of cop. I guess wisely, people that go into being school resource officers were not the other kind of guy that wanted to be the cowboy.
I think that when you see what happened in Ferguson, you see the militarization of the police go wrong. There's not one program out there, folks. There's a bunch of different programs from both the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland
Security.
Through $34 billion worth of equipment have been given to hundreds and hundreds of police departments and state policing agencies. And that sounds good on the surface, but we now see that there's problems with that. And I just think in terms of, tanks and armored personnel carriers, extremely provocative to come at people like, if you're the military and they're like the enemy, like you're in Iraq or somewhere, to come on to American citizens like that, whether you're a libertarian or a conservative or a liberal or whatever, it's gonna not make you any friends, I don't think.
There's a lot of listeners out there that are saying probably, hey, the cops need it. I mean, this is a thankless job. It's in their heart of hearts, they're saying it's not so bad. So they're getting some extra stuff.
It ranks number 10, tied with taxi drivers for being a dangerous profession. There are 9 professions considered more dangerous. The other thing I'd like to point out is that this thing has become politicized, but it seems to me that this is what we're talking about with the militarization is the Tea Party and the Libertarians' worst nightmare. This is what they've been worried about. And so I don't see how it can be politicized. It's something that we all should be concerned with.
Some of the angriest books and stuff are by libertarian, not liberals. I think a little moderate. We want to announce the Door Picnic, Democrats of the Red Rock Picnic. It's on Sunday, September 14th. From 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., U.S. Representative Ann Kirkpatrick is going to be there. D.J. Quinlan, who's head of the Democratic Party in Arizona. Felicia Rodolini, who's a candidate for Attorney General.
How about Goddard?
not coming.
Not coming. The candidate for
admission is $5 a person. That includes lunch, hot dogs, hamburgers. Mike and Gary are hot dog hamburgers.
See you next Monday.
And it's like a, it's sort of like a 4th of July picnic, but you've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.